That's what I've been on.
For the Oregon Health Plan?
We couldn't find it.
Ready?
All right. House Committee on Revenue for February 28, 2017 will come to order. We're going to begin in the order that things are printed in the agenda, information meeting. I will simply note, colleagues, that we have, this is the last meeting of the month of February. We've already passed one-fifth of the session, and only have four-fifths left to go, rough numbers. Debt advisory report. The treasurer's office is here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for coming.
But just in case, Greg and Jody are here.
Please.
Okay, hi. For the record, my name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the Director of the Debt Management Division on the Oregon State Treasury. And I was asked to come today to speak to you briefly about the findings from the 2017 State Debt Policy Advisory Commission report. We do this report annually to evaluate the state's debt capacity. It's required under statute. The commission is made up of five members. The chair is a state treasurer. There's a representative from the legislature, who's your chair of House Revenue, Representative Barnhart. Senator Devlin is the representative currently serving from the Senate. We have the director of DAS, and then we always have a public member who's currently Tim Dewey, who's an economist at the University of Oregon. Our goal is to provide guidance as to long-term debt policies, to give you a sense of our current credit rating and the debt environment in terms of state debt. For some of our newer members, I'm going to briefly talk about this, but our entire report's available, and I was told by Paul Warner that if copies haven't already been made available to you, we can give you the whole report. But there's four major categories of bonds. Our general obligation bonds are provided in our Constitution. Our Constitution basically says you can't borrow more than $50,000 without a carve out of the Constitution, except for highways. So when you hear about Article 11F or G or P, those were all voter approved carve outs of different general obligation bond programs. Now, there are some bond programs that are general obligation bond that are self-supporting. Those are loan programs for mortgages, for elderly and disabled, and other programs for energy loans and a variety of other things at universities that have their own revenue streams. Generally speaking, we focus more on the general fund supported debt, and the recommendations of the commission are built around how much the general fund is paying of the GO bonds. We also have direct revenue bonds that have been issued over the years through authorization by the legislature for various state agencies. What comes to mind are lottery revenue bonds, which are backed by the lottery streams that we produce through the lottery system, as well as highway user tax bonds, basically ODOT's revenue bonds, which come from user fees, weight mile taxes, and gas taxes. And then we have other revenue bond programs as well. They're smaller for first-time home buyers, multifamily home buyers, et cetera. And then finally, we have conduit revenue bonds. And these are bonds where the state's not really on the hook for the debt. We simply serve as a pass-through entity. We do this for nonprofits, for multifamily housing, and for some of our industrial development bonds. And please stop me at any point if I'm talking too technically. I'm trying to avoid that. What you see to my right is a snapshot of our overall indebtedness over the last decade. I did not include the conduit bonds because they're really not state bonds per se. And what you'll see is that we were just under $10 billion about a decade ago, and we're just over $10 billion a decade later. What that tells me is we've been issuing debt at a pretty steady clip over that past decade. So we're retiring debt at about the same rate that we're bringing new debt onto the books, which should be the goal. You will notice that some categories or colors are growing, and that would be our GO bonds, and what's shrinking is appropriation credits. Several years ago, we passed a constitutional amendment, a carve-out. We had been using COPs, or certificates of participation, to fund things like our prisons, our mental institutions, we started using Q bonds, Article 11Q, which are GO bonds, which are lower cost, higher credit rating. And we've simply refunded a lot of our COPs and turned them into GO bonds and saved interest on the refunding. We saved over $90 million in interest costs as a result of that particular constitutional amendment and the refunding. This is our GO bond specifically, and you can see that it has been growing. I'd suggest that the largest area of growth has been in these Q bonds. Other types of bonds that have shrunk is we don't have as many ODVA bonds. We had a lot of bonds many years ago for mortgages for vets, so that program has shrunk. And you can also see that we have growing amounts of bonds under F, 11F, which is the self-supporting higher ed bonds, which are the enterprises that they run, including parking garages, dormitories, food facilities, et cetera. If there's no questions, I'll keep rolling. Mm-hmm. Direct revenue bonds have bumped up quite a bit. The two primary drivers was the increasing amount of ODOT bonds we've been selling throughout the 2000s for the OTIA 1, 2, and 3 programs, as well as JTA, which is Jobs and Transportation Act. And then also we had a bump in lottery revenues when we introduced video line games. And so the amount of lottery bond issuance also increased during this period. But as you can see, it's actually sort of stabilized in the last few years and come down slightly. We're not issuing nearly as much ODOT bonds as we had. The other areas, we aren't really selling nearly as many single and multifamily housing bonds. It's been difficult to do first-time homebuyer bonds. As interest rates have declined, it's hard to earn a spread between the borrowing cost and the loan cost. And then lastly, as I mentioned, COPs have dropped. It won't go away completely because we've sold some COPs for some local correctional facilities. And the key thing about 11Q bonds is it needs to either be owned or operated by the state. And so those COPs will continue to stay on our books until those are paid off in full. As I mentioned, we really focus in our debt capacity report on general fund supported debt as well as the lottery bonding debt. So I'm going to focus on that first. The goal of the general fund is to keep the annual debt service within a reasonable amount so that in times that are difficult where revenues drop, the state is not in a position where we have to cut probably more than we'd otherwise cut because we have so much debt on our books. There's no perfect number, but the rule of thumb that the commission has used for many years is to keep general fund debt service at no more than 5% of general fund revenues in a given year. There are some states that have a lower percentage, and there's other states that have a higher percentage. It's just been kind of the average among the states that we've kept it at that level. So I'm going to walk you through that first. So these are all the different kinds of bond programs that are considered general fund supported. What you'll notice is not all of any one bond program might be 100% general fund supported, and we've tried to allocate out the percentages of each. Probably the biggest thing to note is that we did sell pension obligation bonds back in the 2003-04 timeframe. Only about a third of that POB debt service is repaid by the general fund. The balance is repaid by the universities, by ODOT, by the Oregon Health Authority, and all the other state agencies. So that's the biggest single GO bond debt we have. But again, only about a third of it is general fund supported. So we're almost exactly at the same number as we were in 2015, which is $2.8 billion. The legislature authorized quite a bit of general obligation, general fund supported debt this in 2015 and 16. However, you didn't give us a lot of debt service to go with that. So we're in the middle of selling most of the debt that was approved in the last few years in this month and just completed a $475 million sale a few weeks ago. And we'll be opening bids for the 11P bonds, which are the school bonds, tomorrow. So as a result, our overall indebtedness hasn't really gone anywhere. But it will be rising when I show you this number in 2017 because we're about to issue quite a bit of the debt that was already authorized.
Do you plan to talk about interest rates later?
I can tell you that when we opened the bids, when we did the deal that we just did, which had an average, not everything was 25 years, but let's just guesstimate 20, our all-in cost of funds was 3.1%.
And I take it from the smile that you're happy about that.
Well, yes, I am.
Good. Thank you.
I'm always happy when we can borrow at very decent long-term rates. You know, we always conservatively in this capacity analysis assume a much higher rate. Mm-hmm. As the chair will tell you that I struggle with what interest rate to use. And consistently, we've actually borrowed a bit lower than we've planned for, which mm-hmm. is the goal.
And, of course, in the market that we're facing today, if there's a change in interest rates, they will be higher, generally speaking, in the market. And, therefore, a bond like this will be less valuable. And so the fact is that you're able to get that kind of interest rate is a great testament to the value of Oregon bonds.
Through the chair, I would say our strong credit ratings have been very helpful. We were able to refund, as you'll hear about some problems at Department of Energy, we were able to refund some of their bonds and save them several million dollars as well in interest costs, which will really come in handy given the size of their problems. So the answer is yes. We're borrowing at historic levels. Now, rates did start creeping up on the short end. The feds have raised the short end. But when we borrow, we kind of pay more attention to the long end of the yield curve. We're thinking about where 30-year Treasury rates are, and a lot of the muni market is based on those longer-term rates. We are not a AAA. We're a AA+, and we trade within generally 10 to 12, 13 basis points from a AAA scale.
Representative Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On those pension obligation bonds, what's been the average rate of cost on those?
Those bonds were issued back on a taxable basis. They can't be issued tax exempt under federal tax law. And when we sold those bonds in 2003, slightly before I came on board, they were sold non-callable. The blended cost of funds was 5.75%. I have wished for many years that we would have been able to refund those bonds, but unfortunately, couldn't be done. Most bonds in that era were priced the way taxable bonds are, and that market, that was not a very common thing to have a call feature. The tax-exempt market, we always put in call features, and I fight to get them even in our taxable deals today, just because interest rates tend to go up and down, and you want to jump in and be opportunistic when you can be.
Follow-up question?
Please, yes.
If we were to borrow today, what would the rate of interest be?
Well, I have, through the chair, how much do you want to borrow? And then I'll tell you the answer. If you wanted to borrow a little bit, it probably wouldn't hurt our credit rating. But if you wanted to borrow at the level that would extinguish as much as possible the state's unfunded liability, my guess is we would be downgraded. And so the interest rate, I mean, it would be in the 4-something rather than the 5-something. But where in the 4-something would depend upon what our credit rating was. If we borrowed very large, and I can talk more about that as we get into our tax-supported debt, our existing debt ratios, and I've testified a few weeks ago at another committee about what happened with Alaska, where they were going to do a $3 billion pension obligation bond, and basically the S&P said, you will be downgraded if you do it, and they withdrew the transaction from the market.
One last follow-up.
Please, yeah.
At some point in time, it would be great to have the treasurer's office show us in an analysis why borrowing pension obligation bonds doesn't make sense. There's been conversation in this building about taking out pension obligation bonds to buy down our accrued liability as it relates to PERS. And the word I keep hearing is that it's not a good idea. Would it be possible to get an analysis on that?
Sure, but through the chair, I think that I did a presentation that talked about it's a trade-off, which is that our cost of funds will go up because we will most likely be downgraded. As far as an economic analysis of whether it's a good or a bad idea, that's sort of above my pay grade to do the kind of Monte Carlo simulations.
Well, what I'm trying to get at, Mr. Chair, is trying to get everyone to talk together on this issue and to get your understanding, but then to offset it with the cost that's being incurred in the Ways and Means process. Mm-hmm. Of additional obligations we
sure.
have to fund.
I think that's an excellent kind of study to do. We've done it a couple of times before, although not recently, I think.
And maybe that could just be forwarded to me if it's already been completed so I can read it.
I don't think we did it, but at the Workforce Committee that's looking at pensions, a week or two ago, both myself and the chief investment officer testified. The problem with pension obligation bonds from an analytical perspective is you'll never know whether it was a good or a bad idea until the bonds are paid off, because it's not just simply I'm amortizing an unfunded liability at 7.5 and I'm borrowing at 4 and whatever. You also have to take into consideration what the pot of money that you set aside in a side account at PERS earns each year. And those communities that sold pension obligation bonds in 2003, they did it at the bottom of a market. And so the first few years, they were able to earn a very good rate of return. They kept the corpus alive. Those who sold bonds in the 2007-08 timeframe, their corpus, they had to draw so much money out of the side account that they will never be able to break even. So when I say we need econometric modeling, which is kind of above my ability, that's what I mean by that, because you have to take into account the probability of different outcomes in different years, both early and in the early years. PERS has studies that show different outcomes, but then you have to run these Monte Carlo simulations over and over and over again to say what's the likely outcomes. And those studies were done for three school districts in 2015 by Eco Northwest. Mm-hmm. And they said you had an 80-something probability of breaking even. And after those bonds were sold, PERS earned 2%. In the first year.
Yeah.
So I appreciate your desire for analysis, but I think short of, you know, paying Eco Northwest to do that or another organization, it still boils down to a bet. And so I think the Treasurer's Office has come to the conclusion that it's very speculative. That's why the Government Finance Officers Association, actually their policy is to suggest avoiding doing this, and that's why rating agencies' perspective is that it may be a good deal, but it could be a very bad deal, and I think that's what our testimony was.
If we could predict now a large rate of inflation along with economic growth over, you know, the next 15 years or so, if we knew that was going to happen, then this would be a great bet. On the other hand, if we knew that the economy was going to be in a stagnant period with very low growth, then pretty much nothing you do is going to benefit dealing with the pension problem we have.
And if I may add one more thing through the chair that I didn't mention, which was, as we talk about this debt capacity, again, we could choose to do pension bonds. We have the capacity under our Constitution. We have to decide then whether we're going to hold to this 5% general fund debt service.
Right.
Because if we decide to do pension bonds, that means we're also deciding not to do any more capital projects or infrastructure for at least a couple of years. Because of a third of the POBs is general fund, that as you're about to see how much capacity we have. So that's the other part of the trade-off. And I'm not saying it's right or wrong. But I think that's what I testified at the Senate Workforce Committee that was looking at this, which was that we couldn't have it both ways, even if we decided we were willing to take the risk of the pension bonds.
Well, just final thought, Mr. Chair, is, again, from a ways and means perspective, there's no doubt about that we've got this accrued liability and that there's this risk associated with it. I hear you loud and clear. On the ways and means side, there's also, though, an obligation to meet expenses that continued to rise. And at some point, to me, it seems like there needs to be an analysis of what is the risk on the accrued liability side, the income side, versus what ways and means over the next 20 years is going to have to pay out, and to do that analysis and to see what the math shows. And I'm assuming someone's done that. If not, someone ought to be. So anyway, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mm. One last thing, if I could, to the chair. When we sold the last set of POBs, as you're talking about the risk rising, those POBs were sold as 25-year bonds. And they took basically mostly a principal holiday for 5 years. And so we still have $1.8 billion of the $2 billion of POBs that we sold 13 years ago, mm-hmm. because they set it up so that there was this budget relief in the 2003 period. I really am strongly opposed to that. I think that was probably good in the moment, but in the long run, that's eating up debt capacity. And it's got ever-increasing debt service between now and when the bonds are paid off. And I believe, I want to say correct me if I'm wrong, 32. So maybe it was 30-year bonds, and then it amortized over 25. I apologize if I don't have exact. But it was obviously what needed to happen in 03 because of the budget crisis. But the ramifications of what it did to the state, again, selling non-callable bonds, has lived with us mm-hmm. for a very long time.
Yes. Representative Betts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you very much for the great work you've done for the state of Oregon over the years that I've had the pleasure of serving while you've been holding down that office so well. The question, I think, to build on Representative Smith's question is how much more of that unfunded liability could we stand before it affects our credit rating? Is it $22 billion now or $24, whatever it is? And if the stock market crashed, perhaps much higher. At what point, if ever, would that affect our credit rating?
Through the chair, the $22 billion is per system wide. And you should note that there's $6 billion sitting inside accounts for people who've already sold POB. So I never think of it as a 22 because there's $6 billion on the side. The state's got $2 billion of it. So the state's portion is the only portion that our pension obligations funds. And that we're only allowed under the Constitution. So we have about a cap under the state constitution of up to $5 billion. Again, we have $1.8 billion outstanding. So the state's liability is over $4 billion in PERS, even with the side accounts. Okay. So theoretically, we could borrow about 3.3. I would be hard-pressed to tell you exactly where the point of the tipping is, but if I could show you sort of where our debt ratios are in this presentation, I think that's a judgment for you all to consider. I'm not sure how much we'd save on interest, because I think what I really am trying to get at is we might save a little bit in interest. We have to amortize the principal, whether they're pension bonds or PERS liabilities. So I don't disagree that we could save a little bit on the interest cost, but think about it. We owe $4 billion in principal, and there's no escaping that by selling bonds. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the bottom line. I want to say that other communities are also, if we could get through the presentation, I can show you kind of where we stand relative to other states to kind of put this in a law. And I'm not saying there aren't problems nationwide, but just to give this some context, if that would be okay with the chair.
I think that would be great. And we might arrange another time to do that, given that it seems to be a significant interest to the committee. Maybe we can figure out a way to make it part of our charge. I'm not sure that it is, but maybe we can make it that. Why don't you go ahead? And I thought your last answer to Representative Smith sort of gave you a good segue into the rest of your presentation.
If that's okay. So in our model, just so you know, these are all the bonds that were authorized by our legislature the last few years. And we'll be selling most of them, although we sold a few in 2016, in the next few months. It's primarily for state buildings, higher ed facilities, the OHSU Cancer Center. We're selling the second tranche of those bonds in March. Public safety upgrades, the deal that I just told you about, that included money for M&N to do seismic upgrades for schools and public facilities. We have construction grants. We're opening the bids for some of those bonds tomorrow. And then in May, we have about $35 million in highway bonds, which are allowed under our Constitution as GO bonds as well. I assumed 4.5% because I'm always wrong. That number has bounced up and down. And I've just given up all hope of knowing where interest rates are truly headed. And we're going to just use 4.5% unless long-term interest rates bump up above that for the foreseeable future. And again, our 5% target. So what the model does is it says, what is our existing debt? And it has, forecasts out how we're going to pay it off. It assumes we're going to issue all the bonds that are authorized under the bond bill, and we add that debt service in, and then says, how much is left that we can issue? We look at the long-term forecast that's provided by the Office of Economic Analysis. Now, you all hear their revenue forecast and primarily focus on the current biennium. But in their appendices to their report, they have a 10-year forecast. So we use that December 2016 forecast when we're preparing this. And basically, we fill in the blanks. And what you can see is that because we haven't been issuing a lot of debt in the last few years, our ratios have improved quite a bit. We were at the 5%. We bumped up against it. But we're forecasting we'll be at 3.4% at the end of this fiscal year. And that we have over the next years of their forecast of roughly $4.56 billion in capacity over time. Now, if we issued it all in 2018 and revenues dropped, then we would probably have to wait a while. So the commission generally suggests that the legislature not do that, but rather that we sort of spread that out. We call it levelizing or averaging it out. And so when we do that and we take that number and we divide it between all the bienniums, that really gets us to the allocation that we recommend to the legislature per biennium. That allows for mid-course correction if revenues drop, if interest rates rise. So that's how we come to the $1.4 billion in new general fund capacity per biennium recommendation. You can see that interest rate changes don't have as big an impact on the number as does drops in revenue. And unfortunately, we saw real drops in, I believe, the 10, 11, 12 time frame. And we did stop selling bonds for a few years, except for the most critical projects that were on the list. And once the economy picked up and the revenues picked up at the state, we started selling bonds again. And you can see how good our debt ratios now are. We've been a strong double A-plus credit throughout the whole period. The rating agencies gave us kudos, if you will, for stopping and slowing down the issuance of bonds during the tough periods. I wish I could offer you AAA, but as long as we have a limited stream of revenue in the form of personal income taxes as our primary revenue stream, and we have initiatives, we'll be happy being a AA-plus credit.
Oh, interesting.
Okay.
Do you want to say just two more sentences on those last two items, the risk issues having to do with initiatives and the volatility of our tax system?
Well, some states have sales tax and they have income tax. And as you can think about it, it's just a diversification. And so generally, when you're more diversified, you generally have more stable streams of revenue, and obviously the credit markets like stability. So obviously those states often get higher credit ratings. We get as good a ratings as you can get given the fact that we don't have as much a diversity. We have pretty good reserves. In fact, we have amazing reserves compared to when I first arrived in the scene in 04. And boy, do I market that and play that up. That is a huge part of our rating presentation, and we do get a lot of credit. And I think that the work this committee and others have done to think about the size of the reserves, given the personal income tax system, has been really a great benefit to the markets in terms of how we are viewed than compared to maybe how we were viewed in the mid-2000s. As far as initiatives, it is what it is. States that don't have initiatives have it easier because the legislature can make decisions, but there's, you know, how we manage through our initiatives and how we work through the initiative process. I think we've modulated some of the negative criticism we've received because we do really, I think, robust fiscal impact statements now for the voters beforehand, and it's not perfect, but because of that, again, we'll unlikely be at a triple A level. But if we could have the strong reserves and a more diverse tax base, I think I could probably win the day.
Representative Bueller.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. Is there a level of reserves that we could achieve that would overcome the lack of tax base diversity to get a triple A rating?
Through the chair, I thought there was a research project that was done about that. Am I correct? That I thought LRO wasn't it about 15 or 20%? I just remember several years ago folks had studied that, and I thought that was the direction the state was heading. I don't know if there's an absolute, but what the goal was is to survive through a recession and then refill it. And what the state has done, because we have the Educational Stability Fund and the Rainy Day Fund now, as well as the 1% leftover fund balance that kicks into the Rainy Day Fund, is we've set things up on an automatic pilot. So even if we drain in a worst-case scenario, we refill. And I think that's the thing that they like, which was the automatic nature of the refills for both buckets.
If that data, if someone's done that analysis, I'd be interested in seeing it.
I thought it was done by someone in Legislative Revenue Office.
Yeah, I think we have it. I think that would be something that useful to get to the committee.
Yeah.
Again, I don't think the analysis has changed much. I mean, the specific numbers might have, but I don't remember enough about it to try to repeat anything from it, except that it was quite a bit higher than what we have now.
However, our forecast, if we don't, through the chair, if we don't need to dig into it by 17-19, we will be at just under, won't we be under around 10% for the biennium, which is 20% in any given fiscal year, which is a remarkable improvement over the zero that we were at when I first arrived in Oregon in 04.
Right. And, of course, you arrived at the very worst moment.
Yes, I did. we were one of the lowest credit ratings in the country when I got here, and we've been on an upward trajectory since then.
You know, the 01 recession was sharp, deep, and required five special sessions plus one. In 03, that was when we borrowed all that money just to close the budget gap.
And we did a five-year delay of repaying our POBs.
And, right.
yeah, I mean, and working deficit bonds. We did our working capital deficit bonds. We did a lot of things that put us at the bottom of the barrel.
Right.
We're not there. We're one of the better credits now in the country. As I said, we probably hit the peak of where we'll be because we're not going to be able to be AAA. But we trade, like I said, within 12 basis points, which is 0.012% of a AAA, which is pretty good.
Yeah, that's really, really great. And, of course, there was a bipartisan decision following that experience to do everything we could to get to where we are now, even though it meant that we didn't spend the money we might have liked to have spent along the way. Yeah, and I'm getting a head nod from our Ways and Means member. Representative
Bueller. Just to follow up, have you analyzed how much it would decrease our debt service obligations if we went from a AA plus to AAA?
Through the chair, assuming we priced like we were a AAA, I think that, like I said, let's just guess that it was 12 to 15 basis points. It may save us in a couple million per year of interest costs. It's not going to save us hundreds of millions, okay. to be perfectly honest. So I think there's other things that are more important than being a AAA, in my humble opinion.
Hey, wouldn't it be prudent to not maximize all our debt capacity, almost like a rainy day reserve fund for debt under the
through the chair? I think we are, because let me go back a page. Our debt capacity in 18 would be $1.3 billion, and then you'd see what would happen. By averaging that $4 billion over the decade, in essence, we are, because as I said, we can make mid-course corrections. Okay. So we took the full amount of capacity, again, the 10%, and we said, okay, let's try and take that full decade's worth, and let's use some now, and then let's have about the same amount. It really also helps with capital budgeting for both the governor's office as well as the legislature, because this is virtually the amount of debt that was authorized this biennium is the next biennium. So from my way of thinking, it may not be sort of in a reserve, but I feel like we're trying to not spend our full lot all at once.
One more.
Yeah.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Has there ever been talk of tying a dedicated funding source to an initiative, to a ballot measure? So instead of just reporting the fiscal impact, but actually creating a funding source when we create an obligation?
I think we're outside your area there, aren't we?
I think so.
Yeah, I think we are. Just very briefly, I think it's been considered a number of times, trying to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
Please come up with a plan. I'm only being slightly facetious.
I had one.
Yeah, I'm only being slightly facetious. I think it's not easy to do.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. But, yes, other people have thought of it, too. Yeah. And it hasn't happened yet. But it would be great for the voters, when they're faced with a proposal for a new idea, if they were also faced with how to pay for it. Representative Marsh.
Except that we can point to initiatives on the November ballot, which promise to take money from certain funds where they're simply were competing needs, and people voted for them anyway. I mean, it didn't
right.
help solve any problems.
Well, exactly, and that's precisely why, if we can figure out how to do it, it makes sense to say, here's this Nitsikin new program, and here's how we're going to fund it. It's the second piece that was left out of those ballot measures.
Well, they said how they're going to fund it.
Yeah,
lottery
they said.
Money.
Yeah.
Well, and in one case, yeah, right.
Well, that's a perfect segue to lottery bonds.
Right, and here we go. Thank you. Getting us back on topic. Thank you. The
nice.
Chair is not very disciplined today. Back to the topic.
So the debt capacity committee also evaluates lottery capacity. As Representative Marsh just mentioned, lottery revenue got shifted around in this November. But in our constitution, debt service on lottery bonds is the first priority. And that's we were the first state in the country to bond against our streams of lottery revenue. That was an absolute requirement in order to give the investors in this brand new fangled thing confidence that they would be paid. Over the years, we've sold a lot of bonds for projects through the lottery bond. It's one of our least strings attached. It nearly needs to have some connection to economic development, the environment, or education. And most things we do in state government, for the most part, could fit into one of those three buckets. So you can see it funds all different kinds of things. And while it's not free money, the people who often propose it see it as free money because it's not general fund money. And so there's always about five times as many requests for lottery bond funding as there is capacity. We use a four times debt service coverage test in the indenture. Again, as I mentioned when we first created the program, that means that no more than 25% of lottery revenues could be pledged to debt service for the bonds. Now, we could drop that requirement and open up a junior indenture at three times or even two times, but given the fact that revenue pay-as-you-go lottery revenue is so important and valuable around the state, we simply haven't ever done that. So that does put a constraint on lottery bonding, but the choices are if we do more lottery bonding, that means less actual lottery dollars could bucket drop down to all the other programs that it funds for the state. We use the same 4.5% interest rate, 20-year bonds, and we assume that we plan to be issuing lottery bonds sometime in the middle of March for the $213 million in lottery projects that were approved by the legislature in 15 and 16. Over the past few years, this is just the long-term revenue forecast from OEA for the lottery revenues themselves. Again, just like the general fund, they do a 10-year forecast of lottery revenue. And the red line shows you, at the time of the 15 report, where we thought long-term revenues were going to be. The circle reflects the reduction in transfers from lottery to the state during the video lottery replacement program. And as you can see, at the time, OEA was pretty conservative about whether lottery would really recover because it's a discretionary item in people's budgets. And there's been a remarkable improvement. The blue line shows you where we were in 16 and now where they are in their long-term forecast in 17. Clearly, revenues have been coming in better than anticipated. But you see the drop, and the new drop that's below the blue in 18 recognizes that there's going to be a new casino in La Center. And so that's their current estimate as to the impact on lottery. This is the same material I will be sharing tomorrow afternoon during rating agency calls with the rating agencies for this lottery bond sale that I mentioned we'll be doing in March. They're still better than we thought a few years ago. They're not as good as maybe we thought 5 or 6 years ago. So we use the same methodology that we do for general fund, which we say we're paying off lottery bonds, we're selling new lottery bonds. How much capacity do we have over the forecast period? Let's not use it all but once. Again, let's average it out. So we have $837 million over the next 8 years. And we divide basically by four bienniums, again, so that we have some in reserve and we don't, in case we're wrong and revenues drop more or interest rates go up. And that's how we get to the number of $209 million per biennium. I think at the time that the governor's budget was being prepared, we did some back of the envelope, and her capital budget might have a slightly higher number in the $214, $15 million range. But I think you can at least see the math of how we get there as we get closer. Obviously, a decline in lottery revenue of 10% would pretty much really wipe us out. So that, just something to think about in terms of additional competition. It's a declining resource for us, and I think it's just something to be aware of on a going forward basis.
And those numbers you're talking about aren't necessarily a decline in the dollar amount received, but a decrease in the increase or decrease in the forecast amount.
That's true, but I will say that in our presentations with the rating agencies, we are talking about increased competition from multiple sources, whether it's casinos, the internet, et cetera. While the economists will tell you that there's been a pickup, it's hard right now to know whether it's because of the new machines and whether that, after the newness wears off, whether revenues will stabilize. So it's something we want to be cautious about and how we allocate. And if I were going to decide between general fund and lottery, which one to be super cautious about using it all up, I'd be more cautious about the lottery capacity. For multiple reasons, both because the revenue streams are a little more iffy, but also because lottery revenues need to go in a lot of places. Pay-as-you-go lottery revenues need to go in a bunch of places to help balance the state budget. So net tax-supported debt is the term that we use when the rating agencies are trying to compare us to other states. Not every state has a separate revenue bond program for their ODOT or lottery. So they basically try and compare, to make it more apples-to-apples comparison about where our debt ratios are versus other states, they use this term. So to get to the math of how they evaluate it, we add in all the pension bonds, whether the general fund pays it or other state agencies pay it, all of our Q and COPs that are self-supporting, all of our lottery bonds and all of our highway tax user bonds. So these are our overall net tax supported ratios and our forecast of where we're going to be. And I think the key things to look at is when you look at on a per capita as well as in a percentage of personal income, you can see where we stand. And I'm about to show you the Moody's, and you can see that we're well above Moody's median. So while it's very difficult to talk about if we sold more pension obligation bonds, how would they view us? I think what I wanted to show you is my little layer cake. The green bars is what the medians are. And this is just the personal income, but the per capita debt would also have very similar outcomes. What you can see on the lower levels is our GO bonds, our lottery bonds, our COPs, our general purpose GO bonds. If we only had the first 1, 2, 3, 4, we would be at the medians. But what pushes us well above the medians are two things. One is the ODOT bonds, because we've issued quite a lot for capital projects around the state. And then the pension obligations we already have that have not been paid off, as I said, because of the way we structured the amortization. So adding more to that, I think, is my concern in terms of, again, we could sell more POBs and we shouldn't sell any more GO bonds for capital projects for a few years. So we kind of should pick one of the two if we're going to try and minimize the impact on our credit rating. If we do both and we just say, well, our debt ratios be damned, we can do that. Now, I think the rating agencies see the unfunded liability in PERS in sharper relief. This is only looking at public debt. So Moody's in particular took a long time for them to say, hey, there's balance sheet debt and there's public debt. And it turns out nationwide, there's more balance sheet unfunded liability than there is public debt nationwide. Mm-hmm. When you go across all the states. S&P and Fitch kind of got there first. Moody's is there now in a big way. But so there's that. I think that's an important consideration. This chart that was in the SDPAC report, and I hope you can see it, shows you, now this is CAFRs from 2015, and it shows 50 states. What it's trying to show on a per capita basis is you've got public debt, you've got PERS debt, and then you've got OPEB, which is the other, I always get this wrong, post-employment benefits, which is states that have guaranteed health care. Now, the 2015 CAFR for the state did not include the Moreau decision. So this looks better than we really are, but it's not going to be as good in a year, but we'll get this report. And S&P put it together, and the green line gives you, well, how much resources do you have? And so that's the gross state product, which is a way to try and say, how much resource do you have to deal with this? We have relatively little OPEB debt. We have moderate to, you know, public debt. It's a bit higher than the medians. And, of course, it didn't show our PERS debt of the Moreau decision. So that's going to bump up a bit per capita. But I kind of wanted to show you where the green is how we compare to some of our brethren. Not to say that we don't have huge budget problems that we need to address. But I have to tell you, we're not Connecticut, New Jersey, Alaska, or Hawaii. And when you look at some of their debt, including those, the ones that are really out of control have huge OPEB debt per capita. So that's the retiree health care that they've made promises. And I just think it's a useful thing to keep a track of, and I'll come back and show you once the Moreau decision's fully folded into their numbers where we look. So I'm not ready to say, you know, the ring the bells, but I do want to kind of put where we are in perspective.
Dr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great conversation. Thank you. And this is really, it's really helpful to understand where Oregon lies among the rest of our peers. I'm just curious, what are those states on the far right going to do?
Huh? They're going to join other states.
Well, some of them declared bankrupt.
Well, if I only showed you Puerto Rico's even higher, right?
Oh.
States cannot file for bankruptcy. In New Jersey, I mean, I'll tell you quite honestly, years ago, New Jersey, different governors bonded not just for their unfunded liability, but they also bonded their normal costs.
Right.
And years ago. And they just kept digging themselves deeper and deeper into a hole. So I don't know what they're going to do other than have tax revolts as the citizens
like
pay more and more for debt and less for current services.
Be a 49 state.
I think that's the balance. Yeah. Truthfully, the reports from the rating agencies primarily say you cannot invest or borrow your way out of your pension liability. You need to grow your economy out of your pension liability. That's a hard thing to tell people, but that's the best way. You have to grow your revenues.
Thank you.
Wow. Thank you. Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you. This is a very interesting graph. I'm not sure comparing ourselves to the Titanic on the right way to make us feel good, but my understanding is that TriMet has substantial OPEB liability. Who ultimately has responsibility for covering that liability?
Through the chair, it's not my area of expertise, but it's anybody who's a member of TriMet. So I would believe it's the communities that form TriMet.
So not the state.
Not the state.
TriMet is an independent
special district.
Special district. Now, does the bankruptcy law apply to special districts?
There's a bill. the only special districts currently through the chair that can apply for bankruptcy are irrigation districts in our state. But there is a bill to allow governments to file for bankruptcy that may be coming before your committee. In general,
this was in Congress?
Here, there's a bill that was introduced. I would have to look up the bill number.
Interesting. I was under the impression, obviously erroneous, that Congress controlled the bankruptcy.
In our state, local jurisdictions, except for irrigation districts, are not allowed to file for bankruptcy. But there's a bill that would authorize, if the legislature so chose, to allow local districts.
So perhaps Congress has said it's okay, but we've said it isn't.
That's correct. So states have the ability at the state level to decide whether their local jurisdictions can or cannot. States can't under U.S. Constitution.
Cannot.
That's correct.
Let me just play this through. So under current law, special districts like TriMet can't go bankrupt. And the cities that created the special district can't go bankrupt. Who ultimately then holds that debt obligation?
Through the chair of the communities, whoever sells debt. Now, OPEB liability is not a public debt. It's a unfunded liability. But it's on their balance sheet. It's their responsibility.
Yeah, but it still has to be paid, or it'll be litigated till for years and years and years. So.
But it's not bonded.
Yeah, but it's still debt.
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and we're not answering it today. I think it is a very interesting question, and perhaps somebody might like to take it on. I don't think it's germane to this committee's responsibility today. It might be another day. So,
well, I think it's ultimately to our responsibility if we potentially could be obligated to pay that debt.
Well, that's a different question.
That obligation, I guess.
You may be able to answer that one.
We're currently not under obligation unless the legislature puts us under that obligation. But we have other contingent liabilities I was hoping to talk about today could get to it.
But I don't want to so quickly sweep this away.
But I'd like to move on to the next other topics because we have other things to do. Let's hold that for another day, and be happy to come back to it.
Yeah, I
think it's a great issue to look into, but it's not germane to this report, and I'm not sure it's germane to the other business we have on our agenda for today. And we have about 45 minutes to complete it all. So if that's okay, I'd prefer to go ahead.
Could be germane to the fiscal health of the state, though.
But thank you, and I certainly agree with that. Representative Nose, please.
I'll pass.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Wrong way. So I just wanted to briefly touch on the non-tax supported debt. As I mentioned, there's a lot of programs that the state has that are self-supporting, and this is a list of all of those programs. Generally speaking, there's a loan that's made to an entity. In the case of general obligation, we're in essence providing our credit, if you will, as a guarantor. It allows us to borrow at a lower cost, which we can pass on to some extent the savings to the underlying borrowers. Department of Energy sold GO bonds for many years and provided loans to public, private, nonprofit entities, and they've run into, as many of you may know, a series of problems over the years because of non-performing loans. So again, we're the credit provider, and we have defaults on many of their loans. And we've been worrying about this at the SDPAC report level, and it's reached the point where actually the legislature has an interim task force that looked into this whole issue. The last time we took a look, we thought that they would need cash infusions starting in 2021 that through 2034 that would total about $16 million, so a couple million a year just to help them pay their debt service. As I mentioned, we just recently sold some refinancing bonds. They have to share their savings under their loan agreements with some of their business partners. So probably about half of those savings will actually accrue to the state, it'll help, but it's not going to solve the problem. The interim committee made a series of recommendations, and this is just a list of those recommendations. They've been codified in House Bill 2756, introduced by Representative Hovley and Senator Beyer, which would move the SELP program, which is the loan program, to Oregon Business Development Department. I think the bill also has a cash infusion of a few million dollars from some dollars that aren't being used at Department of Energy so they could get liquidity going again so they could start making loans. A few years ago, if we had done that, we may have been able to grow our way out of the problem, but it's going to be an uphill challenge for us to do that. I think with interest rates being low, most of the good borrowers that they could loan to could borrow themselves at pretty good rates. And the more risky borrowers is exactly the wrong kind of people we should be loaning to, to be perfectly honest with you. But I still think it would be wise for the folks at Oregon Business. And so the commission, Treasury, we are supporting the bill to move it to, there's more loan officers who have a bit more savvy about business loans to the private sector. So if we are going to loan to those groups of people, we need to make sure we have the right collateral and that we're appropriately evaluating the risk in terms of the interest rates that we charge in the future. Last thing I wanted to touch on is a contingent liability that we have, and that is through the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Program. This program's grown by leaps and bounds over the last decade. Basically, if a school district or community college gets voter approval to sell general obligation bonds, they can come to the state through my office, and we will put them through process, paperwork, show us your financials, and we will guarantee to the investors that they will make the payment on their bonds. And how do we do that? Well, because the state treasurer's office has access to the short-term fund. If 15 days before any debt service payment, a school district for some reason couldn't make the payment, fiscal agent lets us know, and then we make that payment on their behalf, and then we turn around and we can intercept their state aid. So community colleges and school districts have that state aid, and we've been moving along well. When we were not as strong a credit, there was AAA bond insurance available in the private market. Those folks all disappeared after the crisis, of the financial crisis. Mm. There are a few firms that are out there now. They're AA. We're AA plus, so we're still a good deal. But we only charge what it costs us to process the paperwork. We don't charge for risk. We don't have reserves. And the program's just grown by leaps and bounds. So this chart shows you how much the program's grown. It also shows you that we are diverting real state dollars every year to pay pension obligation bonds for local government. That's what the lower blue is showing. Like the state bonds that we sold for POBs, local debt has that upward sloping amortization because it's trying to mirror how your PERS payments would grow. So that amount of debt service is going to keep growing as a percentage of state aid for the next several years, unless state aid grows faster than the debt service, which it could do. So right now, 7% of our school aid is being diverted to pay pension obligation bonds for existing local debt. So similar to the question about how much more state POB should we issue, I pose that we also have a question of how much more local POBs should be allowed to be issued, because it's together between the contingent liability that we've taken on for school bonds as well as the real liability. This is growing to be a pretty big number, and the school bond guarantee number is now over $500 million. I'll be very honest, we have not paid $1 out of pocket, not at all. But the only reason we would pay out of pocket would be in a worst case scenario, like an earthquake tsunami, where property values would be dramatically lower, and I could see us not being able to recover quickly. And I also think in the real world, taking school aid to repay ourselves, if we could just build the property taxpayers in the following year, okay, that'd be great. But if areas are devastated and their property tax base is destroyed, you'll have a zillion problems on your plate as legislators, but the zillion plus one problem will be that we've guaranteed this debt. Some or all of it we'll have to pay, and we'll have to pay it because we'll need access to the credit markets to rebuild the state. And if we don't pay that contingent liability, whatever percentage it is, then we're going to be paying a higher interest on the money that we need to borrow for state building, state roads, and everything else. I'm really deeply concerned. I think we need to think long and hard about whether we should still fund this program except for the most needy school districts, because there is bond insurance available. Granted, they charge 20-25 basis points on the debt service cost. We charge 3. Wow. Because again, I'm just processing the paperwork. Under state law, the state treasurer's office has the ability to cap this program. We haven't done that yet, but I'm starting to let people know that I'm starting to get to a place where I'm feeling that I need to recommend that be seriously considered.
Cap?
The size of this program.
Oh, cap.
Yeah,
sorry,
put a cap.
T rather than
well, because
C.
Debt will be paid off and new debt could come on, but as a contingent liability, it's not on our books. But I'm starting to be concerned that that perhaps we've a nice program that was very helpful when the private sector could offer bond insurance again. Should the state continue to offer this service to school districts? An example, recently we just insured some bonds for a district that's on the coast. They had a pretty good credit rating, and it would have cost their taxpayers maybe $3 million more for the life of the bonds to just go on their own credit rating. But because of our credit rating, they saved that $3 million. But we now kind of own the liability if there is a major event for some to all of their $200 million of principal and interest over the life of the bonds. So that's the kind of stuff that that I'm actually concerned about that's more directly, you know, TriMet's balance sheet's one thing. I'm starting to get more and more concerned that we need to be thoughtful about whether to continue to offer this service. Only six states provide school bond guarantees. We're proudly one of those six, but I'm looking for guidance from others as to whether it's worth it. Except for, like I said, for school districts that cannot get bond insurance because they're small and disadvantaged parts of the state. But whether we should offer to everybody without any hesitation is starting to be make it a little harder for me to sleep at night.
Thank you.
That's all my remarks.
Conclusion. You can see that Representative Bent's comments are very well taken. Laura Lockwood McCall has been extremely valuable resource for the Treasurer's Office and for those of us on the Debt Policy Advisory Commission. Her description of this last contingent liability, I think, points out a big chunk of her value. Her job is to think about those nightmare risks and figure out how we protect ourselves from them to the extent that can be done. Any additional questions for her? Thank you very much for the presentation. You've raised, as you could tell here, you've raised a whole bunch of topics for conversation, which I assume members of the committee will pursue.
Thank you
very much. I noticed that we seem to have everybody here right now, so let's move ahead to the work session. We have a work session on House Bill 2279, which we carried forward from yesterday because of the issue having to do with the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Kyle, do you want to? We'll open the work session on House Bill 2279. Kyle, do you want to give us a quick review?
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2279, this was the last of the bills brought to you on behalf of the Department of Revenue, and it's relating to consolidating the property appraiser classifications. Right now there's three classifications, creating those into a single more or less classification and putting the oversight, moving most of that from DAS under Department of Revenue's umbrella. We do have the fiscal and revenue. There is no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and we did receive word that the subsequent is not necessarily needed. The subsequent Ways and Means, as there's no fiscal.
Great. Representative Benz?
Mr. Chair, I move to request to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means and move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Benz moves to request to rescind the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means and move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. If the bill goes to the floor, I will carry it. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2279 and open a work session on bill introduction. Representative Smith Warner, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move the following LC drafts be introduced as committee bills. LC 2253, dated 2/27/17. LC 2272, dated 2/15/17. LC 3785, dated 2/20/17. LC 4053, dated 2/15/17. And LC 4119, dated 2/21/17.
Thank you. Representative Smith Warner moves LC 2253, LC 2272, LC 3785, LC 4053. LC 4119 be introduced as committee bills. Is there discussion? Representative Vance, please.
Mr. Chair, I checked, but I could not see that there was any attribution on any of the bills. So once again, I'll be a no unless someone wants to take responsibility for them, or one of them, or more of them.
Okay. It's a great question. I will say that it is probable that several of these bills came from my office. I'm in that situation where an idea looked worth looking into. I don't know whether I actually support them or not. I'm not sure that all of them did, however. I think some of them came from other places.
And Mr. Chair, I'll be a no.
Thank you. Any further discussion? I think we better call the roll, and the roll is the motion is on the introduction of the committee bills that I named.
Representative Bueller.
No.
Representative Fernandez.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Marsh.
Aye.
Representative Nose.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
At this time, no.
Vice Chair Smith Warner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Benz.
No.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. Motion carries, and the bills will be introduced, or the LCs will be introduced as committee bills. We'll close the work session on bill introduction, and we have one other item on our agenda, if Paul's ready for it.
Mr. Chair, we're always ready to talk tax reform.
Business tax reform. You're always ready to talk business tax reform. Please go ahead.
Before we get started, Mr. Chair, I just wanted a couple of comments from the Laura's presentation to
yes.
follow up on. Laura talked about a study around the kind of the size of reserves fund, what was an optimal size. Representative Bueller had questions on that. We did do some analysis on that back in 2008 under the restructuring task force, but we also have had a task force this interim that was jointly staffed by us and Legislative Fiscal Office, Senate Bill 800 Task Force, and we got quite a bit of work from the Pew Institute, and they have a report, and it does include that very issue, what's the optimal size, what are the probabilities, and they did some work for looking at Oregon's numbers and also some other states, so we'll make sure the committee gets that. We're in the process of finalizing that report, so that would be another committee discussion. And finally, the bill I think Laura was referring to around local insolvencies is House Bill 2086, which is in the House Revenue Committee now. So it is a bill that's in the committee.
Okay.
But in terms of the business tax reform, I have one piece here just as a follow-up really to a question from Representative Johnson from last week, and that is to look at kind of the relative importance of GRTs or gross receipts taxes in the states that impose them now. And so I went through and looked at where they are and how they, what proportion they are of total state tax revenue, not state and local, but total state. And you can see on the table there, I took the 1415 total state revenue, which is from the census. So that's a common set of measures there. And then to break it down into those particular categories, you have to look at the state revenue departments themselves. Mm-hmm. So they're not quite a match in terms of the data sets, but I think they give you a pretty good relative sense. You can see the CAD in Ohio raised about $1.7 billion in the 14-15 fiscal year, and that was about 6% of total state tax revenue in Ohio. The B&O tax does stand out as the most significant of the gross receipts taxes as a revenue raiser for Washington. It's about $3.4 billion, most of which is general fund for the state. And again, that's a yearly number for 14-15 fiscal year. So they're raising now about $7 billion per biennium. And that's about 16.5% of their state tax revenue. Nevada, which just instituted its commerce tax, I have the 14-15 total state dollars from the Census Bureau, which is about $7.5 billion. The number you see on the commerce tax there is actually 15-16, which is its first year of operation, and I believe that number should go up when it's more fully in place next year. I think their estimates were a little over $200 million, but you can see that that's a relatively small revenue source for them at $144 million, or about 1.9% of their total taxes. One thing about the Nevada commerce tax, this was put in place as an additional tax revenue source, unlike Ohio, which is was put in as part of an overall tax reform package that had some income tax reductions, property tax reductions. The other tax I have there, and I mentioned putting in their tax twice for some reason, but in Texas, which raises about $55 billion in state tax revenue, the margin tax, which used to be their franchise tax, the margin tax raises about $4.7 billion or 8.5%. So it was designed as a substitute for their old franchise tax that they had, and I believe most of that is general fund dollars. The margin tax is calculated as a in three ways. One is taking gross receipts and subtracting out cost of goods sold, which gives it kind of a moving more toward a value-added type consideration. Total labor compensation, or 30%. So the taxpayer can choose which of those methods they use. And you can see that it's a little less than 10% of Texas's total state tax revenue.
I represent Nose.
I can't help but make an observation on this. I mean, I know this is about gross receipts taxes, but I think the second column in where it's showing the total state revenue for that biennium, it's very interesting to me that I don't think of the state of Washington as that much bigger, at least in population, but their state budget is twice ours. And then you look at them relative to Ohio, which is much larger in population. And then, you know, the Ohio budget really is not double the state of Washington's, which I find it's very interesting to me.
Mr. Chair, those dollars are state tax dollars. So one of the things that you see across the country is different levels of centralization in terms of how much is raised by the state versus the local. So that's one of the facts. I know one of the issues around Washington is they have, I would say about 15% of their property taxes are a state levy. So it's a property tax for schools, and it shows up as state revenue. Mm-hmm. So that would add to Washington's state tax collections.
All right.
Whereas in Oregon, we have no property tax revenue. It's all local.
Okay.
So those little nuances, I think, come into play. But Washington is definitely.
You can see the importance of actually accumulating the taxes when you're thinking about making comparisons. The one we just heard, for example, that state and local distributions are very different in different states. And if you want to know what the comparison is, you got to add them all together. Mm-hmm. It's just one more illustration of that point.
Mm-hmm. So, and Mr. Chair, the last line there is, and of course, many of you were here in that debate where how to replace the $10 minimum tax, what was the appropriate base. You looked at some of these similar issues, value-added, gross receipts, and the legislative decision, which was built into Measure 67, was to use a gross receipts type base to calculate the minimum for C-Corps only. And you can see for the 14-15 fiscal year, we raised about $41 million through that bracket, as you recall, from zero up to 100,000. A cap for 100 million in sales. So about 41 million, which is less than 0.5% of state tax revenue.
Okay.
So that's what I have on the business tax reform. Chris has been doing a lot of work on looking at some examples. I know there's been interest on how we how this would affect making changes to these different bases for individual businesses in different situations, organized as different entity types. And so Chris has some examples for you to think about.
Great. The committee did ask for examples of specific kinds of businesses so that we can get some sense as to how these things actually would work. So Chris has tried to pull it together for us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office.
Simple examples.
And hopefully this won't feel too much like torture. I'll go through the examples. An exercise in death by example, I suppose. So what I have here are very simplified examples. Basically, the parameters here are cost of goods sold, sales, what I've called margin, and then taxable income to arrive at an income tax liability, and then the OBPT tax liability. And a lot of these are examples. To get some sense of a reality check on the numbers, they're based on aggregate U.S. statistics from the IRS. And then margin, for example, is just a percentage of taxable income as a percentage of sales. So I've just tried to link everything together, but keep that in mind. These are rough examples. But the first example here, we have a retailer who purchases $315 million. That's their cost of goods sold. And they sell them for $500 million. And with a margin of 2%, they get to a taxable income of $10 million. The corporate excise tax on that is $749,000. That's just the 6.6 and 7.6% brackets. A half a percentage point Oregon business privilege tax would be $2.5 million. That's simply the half a percent times the sales here. And so under a policy of eliminating the income tax and establishing the privilege tax, that would be a tax increase of $1.8 million. It's important to note here that in this hypothetical business privilege tax, it kicks in right on the first dollar earned. So it's applied to the full $500 million in sales. There's no kind of zero bracket or exemption level. That would be a policy level. But just to try to keep it as simple as possible, it starts right off in that first dollar. The second example here, we have a software designer. As you may recall from last week or so, the cost of performance. So a couple of key factors I've thrown in here. All of the costs are incurred in Oregon, and they have $100 million in sales in Oregon and $145 million in Idaho. So they have cost of goods sold of about $34 million, total sales of $245 million, and with a margin of 5%, they have taxable income of $12.1 million. That's about $900,000 of corporate income tax. And the privilege tax would be $500,000. That's just multiplied by the $100 million of sales in Oregon. Okay. And so the difference there, their tax would actually go down by $400,000 in this very simplified swap. Now, if I take that same example and just change all of the costs are in Idaho instead of Oregon, so the same, all of the, everything else is the same, but all of their costs occur in Oregon, I mean in Idaho, they still have $100 million of sales in Oregon and $145 in Idaho. It's the same $34 million in cost of goods sold, $245 million in sales. Their taxable income is zero because of the cost of performance, kind of under current law, because all of that is done in Idaho, and the cost of performance is an all-or-nothing situation. So then for this company with the privilege tax, their tax would be $500,000, and it's actually a tax increase for this situation, just trying to get at some of the complexities in the income tax and how that compares to the privilege tax. The fourth example here is a high-margin business. So we have architectural and engineering services, cost of goods sold of about $6 million, total sales of $75 million. So a margin of 20% means they have $15 million in taxable income. And their corporate income tax would be $1.13 million. And the privilege tax would be $375,000. And so that's a tax cut of about, a tax reduction of about $800,000. All of these sales, except for the piece up here in Idaho, everything else is contained within Oregon, just for simplified purposes. So those are some examples of the C corporations. So the privilege tax would apply to all business types. So it would apply to a partnership. So we have an example here of a law firm with 10 partners. Cost of goods sold of $4 million, sales of $50 million, with a profit margin or a margin of 40%, they have $20 million in taxable income and $1.5 million in personal income tax. Now, the tax here is calculated at the pass-through rates, not the standard income tax rates of 5, 7, 9, and 9.9. It's the pass-through rates of from 7 to 9.9%. Again, just for simplification purposes, focusing on the business tax portion of that. So it excludes Schedule A deductions and all of the non-business portion of the personal income tax. And the half a percent privilege tax would be about $250,000. Now, I don't have a difference number here because the setup is trading basically the corporate excise tax for the privilege tax. But this represents another layer of policy decisions that would need to be addressed. The next example is a sole proprietor. So we have a in the construction, so for example, a home builder, $2 million in cost of goods sold, $5 million in sales, with an 18% profit margin that's taxable income of $800,000, and an income tax of $76,000, and then the privilege tax would be $25,000. Now, in this case, because it's a sole proprietor, this is the standard 5, 7, 9, and 9.9 rates, because they are not eligible for the pass-through rates. So the next example, we have an S corporation. This is very similar to the partnership. It's a pass-through entity. We have a manufacturer, 10 shareholders, $30 million in cost of goods sold, $75 million in sales, a margin of 13%, means taxable income of just under $10 million, and the income tax here of $718,000 versus the privilege tax of $375,000. And I should note that for the partnership and the S corporation, I assume that the income was split 10 ways. So basically, the tax gets calculated for each of the partners. 1/10 of their income gets taxed. And the totals here are those tax amounts summed up over those 10 shareholders. Mm-hmm. The next example here for the corporations, I go back to a manufacturer and start to touch on the issue of incidence of the tax and whether or not it gets absorbed by the owner of the business or if it gets pushed forward in terms of prices. So kind of the baseline concept here is we have a manufacturer, $393 million in cost of goods sold, and their sales are $750 million. So they have a profit margin of 2.6%, and that's about just under $20 million of taxable income, which translates into $1.5 million in the corporate income tax. The privilege tax would be $3.75 million, so that would be a tax increase of $2.3 million. So the next row here is the same situation, but with a privilege tax and prices held fixed to see what the owner does. So the cost of goods sold goes up by $2 million because the 0.5% gets applied to all of those products. Their sales stay at $750 million. The owner of the corporation absorbed that entire cost increase. And so their margin goes down from 2.6% from 2.6% to 2.4%. Their taxable income goes down by the $2 million because they've absorbed the cost increase in their cost of goods sold. And the income tax for them goes down by about $150,000 to $1.35 million. And the privilege tax stays the same because their $750 million is unchanged. And the last line here, the owners, instead of absorbing the price, they pass it along in the terms of their cost or their products that they sell. So the $394.8 million in cost of goods sold results in a $2 million increase in sales from $750 to $752. Their margin stays the same at 2.6. Their taxable income stays the same at the 9.9 is the original here. Their income tax is the 1.5. And then we see that their privilege tax actually goes up a little bit because their sales, they pass along the cost in increasing their prices. So their privilege tax goes up a little bit here. And so
to actually pass along that cost, they have to do a limits calculation, don't they?
In a sense,
there.
Yeah. And if there aren't any questions here, I have another example where I have three layers.
Okay,
here we have going through a chain, we have products going from a manufacturer to a wholesaler to a retailer, all in Oregon, both with and without the privilege tax. So this first block over here, we have a manufacturer who incurs $20 million in cost of goods sold. So they're purchasing that from other businesses in Oregon is their input. That's their input. Their output is $50 million in sales that they sell to the wholesaler. The wholesaler does their thing, and then they sell those same products at $80 million to the retailer. The retailer does their thing and sells them to the final consumer at $150 million. So that's kind of the chain. It's extremely simplified because all of this occurs in Oregon, and it's just the three businesses there. So with the 0.5% of business privilege tax, the manufacturer, their cost for the cost of goods sold goes up a little bit. That 0.5% gets applied to the $20 million, so now their cost of goods sold is $20.1 million. They're keeping their margin the same. In this example, all of the tax is passed along down the chain. So their sales are $50.4 million. That's the 0.5% for their $50.1 million, because their cost of goods sold went up to 20.1. So they're going to pass along that $0.1 million. So that the sale is $50.1 million multiplied by that 0.5%. So their sales actually go up to $50.4 million. They sell it to the wholesaler for that amount. The wholesaler maintains its margins, and their $80 million over here becomes $80.8 million. And when they sell it to the retailer. And then the retailer sells it to the final consumer, again, at the 0.5%. So the bottom line through this example, the 0.5% privilege tax translates into a 1%, after the pyramiding shown in the example, translates into a 1% tax through these stages here at a kind of macro level, mm-hmm. if you will, for the example. So the last thing I had, the tricky thing about examples is that there's always a tendency to view them as being representative of all taxpayers, and they're not. These examples are set up to try and highlight a few aspects of the privilege tax. So in an attempt to temper that a little bit, here's a distribution from Ohio, and this is the distribution of their filers for the CAT and the percent of filers and the percent of tax. So the blue line shows the percent of filers. So we have most of their filers are down here, mm-hmm. paying okay. relatively small amount of tax. And then here, by the time you get to the largest companies, the blue line doesn't even show up. They have a small number of filers paying the bulk of the tax here. Now, the examples that I picked out would fall in a couple of different places here. And so they don't necessarily represent, or they don't represent, I'd be careful about extrapolating from those examples to get at this is what happens to every company in every particular situation. So the theme, I just wanted to keep that in the back of everybody's mind, that the distribution of filers can be very, or is very different from the examples chosen. I chose them for different reasons. And that's really trying to keep this fairly brief. With some very simplified examples.
Questions, comments? There's quite a lot to absorb, and I'm not surprised that people are being quiet. Representative Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chris, as always, for attempting to make this, for attempting to simplify it, because indeed this is going to be a lot of what we end up talking about is trying to figure out how is this going to impact, because it's going to impact everybody differently. This is kind of a strange question, and I'm not sure you're going to be able to answer it. But I guess I'm trying to get to the why. The why there is the change that there is in these examples. Like, do these kind of demonstrate any sort of a thematic, like, in general, you know, retailers will pay more, service providers will pay less? And the answer may be no. But I'm just trying to kind of get to that. The pass-throughs will, you know, some of the pass-throughs will pay less, some of them will pay more, depending on their site. Do you have any kind of why to this?
Chair Barnhart, Vice Chair Smith-Warner, there are a couple of whys. So part of the example, we have low margin versus high margin.
Good.
So you have a retailer, typically low margin, mm-hmm. Large volume, and so you can get a tax increase. If you're swapping the income tax for the excise tax. And then if you have a business with a high margin, then you can actually get a decrease if you're swapping.
Because you're not paying on income tax.
Because the income tax can be higher. The high margin is high profit, and the income tax, right. That's where the income tax comes from, is the companies with large profits. So depending on their sales, they can be a tax increase or decrease, and that's where the margin comes in. Kind of a high margin, low margin.
Which, if I could interrupt briefly, please. Which you could almost, you could make an argument that that's almost counter to what you know you would think in theory with taxes. You want, if you want it to be progressive, you'd want to get more out of people who are making more profit and less out of people who are making less profit. Although that's the theory behind the income tax, and that just hasn't worked out terribly well for us on the corporate front.
Yes, I often think of progressivity as more of an individual concept than a business concept,
group, but
yeah. That would apply. Another layer here is the cost of performance, some of the technical issues of the income tax, just to show how basically how I can set up the example to be either a tax decrease or a tax increase with just one simple change of where their costs occur, and the implications for having a tax structure based on that, where the system so far has been single sales, and that's been the policy driver for how a tax should be applied, the income tax, and the cost of performance is a deviation from that.
Right. And I would argue on that in this, on the why, that would be a plus for people who are doing all of their, more of their business in the state, because that's what we want to incentivize companies to have their job sourcing, their cost of production, therefore here. In this example, your source is in the state, you're getting a tax advantage. Your source is out of the state, you're getting a tax disadvantage.
It's an export-driven policy.
Yep.
Yes. And then the middle examples here are the non-corporate taxpayers. Mm-hmm. And again, not because this has been set up as, or it's been described as trading the corporate income tax for this other tax. Mm-hmm. That's why I've calculated a difference here. But when we get to these other business types, because we're talking about business tax reform and trying to get everybody to understand that depending on the business structure, they're paying tax through the personal income tax system or not. And that's a policy choice here.
Right.
But you have the partnership, the sole proprietor, and the S-Corp. Mm-hmm. So some deviation for the different policies for business structures that currently exist, the pass-through tax rates, how they affect the partnerships and S-Corps, but not the sole proprietors.
And the why there, we could posit, is one of the complaints that we get is there is a lower incidence of tax paying in large corporations and a higher in small businesses, LLCs, partnerships, et cetera. And this would seem to reinforce that.
Well, and that would...
Well, not reinforce, but perhaps a look, you would pay less if you were a small business, a limited partnership. Okay.
Right, and that important to keep in mind is this rate gets applied to the first dollar sold in this example. So another policy lever is for the smaller businesses that some of the other examples, in Ohio, for example, it's $150 for the first $1 million, and then the rate kicks in. Mm-hmm. So that's a policy choice.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Sure. And the only other comment I would say, I would love to see an example specifically of an ag based business as well, and I don't know how easy that would be for you to model, but that's kind of the other big thing that jumped out at me, that, you know, because that's an industry that we have a lot of discussion about. They do not have a lot of price flexibility when they're exporting and et cetera, so how could this potentially impact them based on how we structured it?
Yeah, I thought about that a little bit, and I almost included ag in here for the wood industry as an example. I don't know that it would get exactly to the point you're talking about, so that I didn't include it here, but this is kind of an ongoing thinking about different ways, the different examples.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.
All right. Yes, sir. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think all this work that he's put in shows the value, I think, of the work that Washington put into their B&O tax. If you start to look at every category, segment of the economy, and put in a rate that is fair in theory, but not overly predatory. And you also look for the pyramiding impacts in certain sectors as well. So it would be interesting. I know it's a huge amount of work, but we always take that Washington model, put it on top of Oregon's economy, and what does that do? Hmm. What kind of outcome do we have here if we could replicate that? But that's a huge amount of work, I'm sure, to go through. Maybe certain sectors we could do that with, though, and that would just for example as we go through this process.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I mean, that one of the advantages of Washington is we do have a lot of detailed data.
Yeah, if we just so don't reinvent
we've got
the wheel,
detailed data
it.
By industry. Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, boy. Representative Benz?
Thank you, Chair. And talking to folks prior to the meeting today, there's rating systems about different types of taxes across our nation, and the gross receipts tax, business activities tax rates particularly low. And I think, and when I asked why, the answer was because of the pyramiding and thus imposing different rates of tax upon basically the same type of taxpayer, depending upon where they are in the in the tax scheme, which is a, if we're talking fairness, then that would suggest that that isn't. There's a word for it, and I forgot it.
Vertical integration?
No, the goal one tries to achieve by taxing everybody about the same.
Oh, equity?
Yeah, well, that's still not it. But in any event,
Neutrality.
Yeah, neutrality, exactly. Oh. So this is what we would call a violation of the neutrality we try to achieve in these kinds of tax systems. And the suggestion, therefore, was that to get back to neutrality, we would look at something different, or we're going to find ourselves stepping from one unfortunate circumstance to another. But I guess the question is, how do we measure the true cost of that lack of neutrality this device would create here in Oregon?
I think that some of that is just going to be a value judgment on somebody looking at it in terms of, it's almost a fairness. If it's fair or not fair, you have that aspect, which will be a value judgment. What we can look at are some of the consequences and some of the incentives that get created. So, for example, here, this type of past pyramiding right here exists because these are three independent companies. If to avoid this, the retailer can buy the wholesaler and the manufacturer, and you vertically integrate, and they've avoided the tax. So we can look at some of those aspects and the consequences and the incentives created by the tax, and that would help inform the discussion.
Follow up.
Mm-hmm, please.
If we go back to your other chart, the final chart, and we look at the number of filers below 1 million, can't we anticipate that most of them won't be engaging in buying the folks further up the ladder, and thus they will perhaps be paying most of the pyramid tax? So when we talk about fairness or neutrality, the largest scope of people, I'm assuming, are in that blue column, because it's the number of filers, would be treated the most shabbily if we're using a neutrality standard. Or am I wrong on that?
I wouldn't think, if we're talking about companies with, so here we have the smallest companies with $1 million in sales versus up to $1 billion. I'm not sure how much vertical integration there would be for the companies that only have $1 million in sales.
Can you repeat that again so everybody understands what you just said? Mm-hmm.
So what we're comparing is a small company defined as $1 million in sales versus a large company, $1 billion in sales. A company that's only selling $1 million, I don't know that there's a lot of room for pyramiding at that end.
Yep.
I mean, there could be.
Let me interrupt you right there, if I may. I'm talking about what they buy, not what they sell. They're going to be paying
right.
higher prices because they're the ones paying the pyramided price. They're not in a position to stack their operation because they can't go buy everybody above them. They have to buy it at its higher price as it makes its way into their business.
It potentially, it depends on the kind of business that they are.
There's a lot of them.
Right.
Most law firms presumably make less than $1 million, and their margin's pretty high. So.
If we're talking about, I mean, you have service firm.
I'm talking about everybody in that blue column with far more than law firms.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
In fact, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Please.
That law firm. All of us lawyers in this room want to be a partner in that law firm.
That law firm. Yes.
I've never seen anything like that. $5 million per partner, or whatever it is.
10 partners, $50 million yeah. total sales.
Yes. Right. Yes.
We'd be happy with that one.
Yeah. Must be 1,000 associates.
So, yeah, the pyramiding is, for example, here, the pyramiding that occurs here is all of the manufacturing, all of the wholesale, and all the retail occurring in Oregon. I mean, that's the thing about the pyramiding. It can be real. It depends on where each one of those occurs. So if I set this up so that the manufacturer and the wholesaler aren't in Oregon, it's only the retailer, it affects the amount of that pyramiding. And that's why one aspect, a lot of examples are really needed to encourage the discussion and think about it. Oftentimes for the other models we use, OTIM, for example, the bottom line will be consumer prices. The bottom line, broadly speaking, this is the average increase in prices across the economy. And that informs the discussion, at least on a general level. There can always be examples where it can be very high or very low. It depends But that's almost my point about the examples that I've provided here. This isn't a means to, this isn't the end of the story on all possible examples that could exist. It's really just a first step.
That's for sure. Representative Nellis?
Can we go back to the slide we were just on? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, kind of thinking about what Representative Benz was just saying, isn't it more likely, though, that the filers down there in that big blue bar column, they're going to have more ability probably to pass on whatever tax we allocate to their customers? They're small, and they're just going to build that into their price. Whereas the folks that are playing out there in the yellow bars far out there on the right of that graph, they're national players. They have national pricing strategies, potentially, and they got to think about, can they pass that cost on, or are they going to absorb it, or it's...
Or do they pass it along nationally?
Well, but...
A little bit in every place.
I don't know. I mean... Do you, depending on what our rate is, are you really going to pass on Oregon's gross receipts tax to the entire United States, depending on what the rate is? I mean, we're a small state. I don't know.
None of us are, as far as I know, are involved in those kind of decisions in very large businesses. And so
that's a good point.
And I suspect it depends on what kind of large business it is.
It can be very, so the examples here, this bottom one, are kind of the extremes of holding the prices fixed. So you have, this is consistent with some of the assumptions we make in other models. They're exporters, so they're price takers, and kind of like the ag situation. So then they absorb it. Here it would be, and then this line is the other case where they don't have to absorb any, but they get to maintain their margin. Now every company, the size and the industry, it's all going to come down to the competition that they face.
Exactly.
And there isn't necessarily a uniform, I don't know that there is a uniform answer for all businesses, let alone a sector. It's going to come down to their individual circumstances, I think.
Okay.
It's a very competitive situation. We make it.
So,
Representative Smith is reminding us that we're past our committee time.
Okay.
I very much appreciate the presentation today. Committee, tomorrow we have a lot of people. Please, we're not finished yet. Please. Tomorrow, Representative Nose, please. Tomorrow, we expect to have a lot of people here in connection with one of the bills that we're hearing.
Yes.
So please be prompt. I'm going to have the clock running, and we're going to hear as many people as we can manage in that process. So I warn you today, please review the material for tomorrow, before tomorrow, so you already know about it.
Is it on OLIS?
He'll make sure it's on OLIS in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. And with that, thank you very much for staying late, and the committee is adjourned.